WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for June the 10th, 2018. It's our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we go from the fifth floor of City Hall to the second floor in Springfield, all the way out to Washington, D.C. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, kind of a different arrangement we've got today here as we continue the exodus from Tribune Tower. Dave's over in the new digs across the river on the 18th floor. And are you in the fog up there?
Yes. A lot of people have said that for the past 61 and a half years.
Yeah, I was afraid to raise that just as at the start.
But yes, the answer is yes. We are on the 18th floor to give our listeners a little better perspective as to how high up we are. And definitely...
Have they been saying that for the last 61 and a half
years? Probably. Yeah, heads in the clouds. with the heavy rain, and I just want to mention, too, very quickly, Rick, that the huge storm that we had about 4 or 5 this morning is now moved off to the east, but there are other smaller storms that are coming up this way, just getting a little bit north of Bloomington now, moving toward Ottawa and headed into the Chicago area. So we'll see more rain later on.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Well, you know, with everything that's been going on here at Tribune Tower, and obviously the radio newsroom has now moved over to its new digs, and Friday was the last day for the newspaper to be in its namesake Tribune Tower. So a lot of moving and packing going on.
Your colleagues have really chimed in on their feelings about the move. No, seriously.
Well,
they have.
Yeah.
I've been reading, you know, various comments and columns about it.
Well, I will tell you, if you really want to, my favorite ode to the tower is by my former cubicle seatmate, Rick Hogan, in today's paper, which I think says an awful lot about everything in the history here. It's kind of, I had talked to him about there's a lot of ghosts in this place. And
there are.
They're not all Casper, the friendly ghost, either. there's a great deal of history here. And there's a certain lament. Change brings that kind of thing. But
someone asked me if the ghost of Colonel McCormick will still be in the throughout the hallways as the move continues.
I don't think the colonel ever left this place.
No.
And the colonel will never leave this place. This was his place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they moved his desk out of here a long time ago, and the 24th floor office still remains as a imposing representation of himself. And of course, you know, the fact that the wood paneled office and the fake door, the fake wall in it, that actually was an escape door because of he was so afraid that during FDR's term that the Marines were going to come and seize the newspaper.
To mention after Dewey Defeats Truman was published.
Well, things changed for a while after that. We weren't not so quick on the trigger as much in calling election contests. But, you know, I think about this building on the seventh floor where Dave used to be in the newsroom. Just outside the newsroom was CNN. Was their Chicago bureau, and that was outside that door that I saw and talked to Rod Blagojevich for the last time as a free person before he was arrested less than 12 hours later.
Wow. Well, we have a sole survivor on the seventh floor.
Yes.
Yeah. You guys have to be talking about ghosts while I'm sitting here all alone on the seventh floor.
All by myself.
It's like 117 degrees in here, by the way.
Yeah, it's not... I think the thermostats all got turned off.
Yeah, a lot of it got turned off. I was just surprised the lights worked still. Thank goodness they do.
Well, turn them off when you're done.
We would have let you in over here.
Turn them off when you're done.
Well, the last person out, please turn off the lights.
Exactly, exactly.
Andy has left the building.
Yes, I have.
Well, speaking of lights out, how about the new Triple Crown winner?
Pretty impressive, huh?
Justify poll to poll.
Yeah.
Which I think that was going to be the big question mark going in.
Yeah, it wasn't even much of a race.
No.
He got out to a real big lead and kind of cruised to the Belmont Stakes yesterday, Triple Crown, and it's the first since 2015, just the 13th overall. I mean, you think about how long they've been racing horses, and that's just 13 of them that have won the Triple Crown.
Yeah, that's horse racing is like the most exciting 2 minutes in sports.
Yes, it
really is. A lot of fun to watch. Of course, we've ended the hockey season. We've ended the basketball season with Washington defeating the Golden Knights of Vegas in 5 games. And Golden State Warriors, just too much for the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps in the final game again in a Cleveland jersey for LeBron James.
I'm thinking that too. And I don't think there'll be the reaction in Cleveland as there was last night.
Because you can't reburn a jersey you already burned. You know?
Well, but Kevin Durant, I mean, come on. Just amazing.
Well, it just kind of goes to show you what the NBA has become. Because, you know, Jordan was able to do it with Pippen.
Right.
And now you have to have three.
Yeah.
So it's basically you have to have three scoring options on your team, and you're pretty much a shoe-in to win an NBA title. And, you know, play a little defense here and there and get the breaks, and you're good.
No, where does LeBron go?
You know, there's been so much talk about the Lakers because they'll have a lot of cap space. There's some talk about the Philadelphia 76ers.
I think that'd be a good match.
Yeah, that'd be pretty kind of cool with Ben Simmons and the rest of those guys over there. And I think that, you know, who knows if maybe the Bulls get involved. They got some cap space.
Yeah, I don't know about
You put a rebuild on hold if you can get a guy like that.
Yeah, definitely you do. Yeah, or you readjust the rebuild.
Exactly.
That's for sure. Well, a great win by John Lester yesterday for the Cubs. I think it was a three-pitcher combined one-hitter.
Correct it is. And, the Cubs have now creeped within a half a game of first place.
And the bullpen's doing tremendous.
Yeah, not only are they dancing for home runs, but they're also getting batters out.
Yeah, which is what we'd prefer.
Mm-hmm.
But, ERA under 2, ninth shutout of the season for the Cubs.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing well. They won 11 of the last 13, and a lot of people were panicked early on in the year when nothing was going right. Jason Hayward starting to swing the bat as well.
Which is good to see.
Which is really good because Chris Bryant had struggled, and Anthony Rizzo went through a little funk there as well. But, yeah, they can go for a sweep today with Kyle Hendricks against Ivan Nova, and they'll finish up their series on the north side today.
And we've got the Sox, too.
We do. It was good news in one respect yesterday because Carlos Rodon made his first start of the year, first start on a big league mound since September of last year when underwent surgery at the end of September of last year and worked his way back. Didn't get a lot of help from his defense behind him, but pitched pretty well in 5 innings. He actually hit about, I think he hit 96 a couple of times, so I think he's feeling pretty good.
That's pretty healthy. That's really healthy.
That's not bad.
And, of course, we've got the Sox playing again today.
Correct. I have pregame at 11:30 this morning, a little breakfast with the White Sox today, and 12:05 is the first pitch here on GN.
Very good, very good. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Casera's here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, and we're on Twitter @SymbolSundaySpin, and Engineer Bob needs an empty box. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast by going to iTunes and searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Ahead on the Sunday Spin, after the 7:30 news break, we'll speak to Bill Fleishley. He's the Executive Vice President of the Illinois Petroleum Marketers Association. We'll talk about his group's opposition to a move to raise the state age for purchasing tobacco products from 18 to 21. After the 8 o'clock news, we'll speak to Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza, and we'll talk to her about some recently passed bills involving transparency and budgeting. And then after the 8:30 newscast, we'll speak to Republican State Representative Tim Butler of Springfield. He's a member of the state's Bicentennial Commission, and we'll talk about the 200th anniversary celebrations going on across the state. That's all coming up. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in historic Tribune Tower on a soggy and foggy North Michigan Avenue on this Sunday morning. Time for our weekly spin through national politics, and the president soon to arrive in Singapore for the highly anticipated summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The president departing from Canada, where the G7 meeting was held, and actually raising more questions about whether really it's the G6 plus one, the one being the United States, the president instructing the U.S. not to sign on to a diplomatic statement about the G7 conference. In a tweet, the president said that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of Canada acted so meek and mild during our G7 meetings, only to give a news conference after I left saying that U.S. tariffs were kind of insulting and he will not be pushed around. Very dishonest and weak. Our tariffs are in response to his 270% on dairy, which is kind of interesting because when the president imposed these tariffs, he said it was due to national security. I'm not exactly sure what the role of dairy products has to do with our national security. I'll defer to those in the agriculture industry on that. The president went on Twitter to say that based on Justin's false statements at his news conference and the fact that Canada is charging massive tariffs to our U.S. farmers, workers, and companies, I've instructed our U.S. reps not to endorse the communique as we look at tariffs on automobiles flooding the U.S. market. So certainly, well, there was a great picture taken by German Chancellor Angela Merkel's press office of her reaching over a desk as President Trump sat in a chair with his arms folded, almost looked Norman Rockwell-ish, and spoke volumes about what occurred in Canada for the G7 meeting. Now, you know, obviously, there's still the swirling going around the presidency. No one seems to appear more on television lately than Rudy Giuliani, the former New York mayor who is now one of President Trump's top lawyers. Last Sunday, appearing with George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week, Giuliani was asked if Trump, as president, could pardon himself.
Do you and the president's attorneys believe the president has the power to pardon himself?
He's not, but he probably does. He has no intention of pardoning himself, but he probably does. It doesn't say he can't. I mean, that's another really interesting constitutional argument. Can the president pardon himself?
I think it's an open question.
I used to run the pardon attorney. It would be an open question. I think it would probably get answered by, gosh, that's what the Constitution says, and if you want to change it, change it. But, yeah.
Actually, the Department of Justice has already said that a president cannot be his own judge and jury and cannot pardon himself. But that's Rudy Giuliani. Also in that same interview, Stephanopoulos asked Giuliani about these shifting recollections over the statements issued about Donald Trump Jr.'s Trump Tower meeting with a Russian lawyer. In the past, Trump's lawyers said that the president wasn't involved, and the White House then said, the president weighed in, but he didn't dictate it. Well, then there was a letter released from the lawyers at the White House, obtained by the New York Times, and the documents from the president's lawyers said the president did dictate the statement. So Stephanopoulos asked Giuliani about that.
I remember when this was first reported, Jay Sekulow was on my program, so the president had nothing at all to do with that letter. Later, Sarah Sanders said, he sort of weighed in, but he didn't dictate it. And now this letter from the president's lawyer say very, very clearly he dictated the statement. How do you explain those shifting explanations?
Happened to me with the whole situation of repaying the money that was laid out by Cohen. When the president first talked about it, nobody focused on it. Nobody thought about it. That was a very busy time. And then when we got on board, I went through everything. it was the only change we had to make. At that point, this other change had been made. When you consider the big scope of this narrative,
it's not a very complicated thing. The president was there. He was dealing with the letter. At first, it was all denied, and now you're saying he dictated.
But I don't know that Jay, Jay would have to answer that, and I've talked to him about it. I think Jay was wrong. I mean, this is the reason you don't let the president testify. Our recollection keeps changing, or we're not even asked a question, and somebody makes an assumption. In my case, I made an assumption. Then we corrected, and I got it right out as soon as it happened.
So that's Rudy Giuliani's explanation. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was also asked about her past statement that the president didn't dictate the statement when his lawyers said he did.
If you're saying the one thing from the podium that it wasn't dictated by the president, his lawyers are saying something entirely different, contradicting. How are we supposed to know what to believe? How can we believe what you're saying from the podium if his lawyers are saying it's entirely inaccurate?
Once again, I can't comment on a letter from the president's outside counsel. I direct you to them to answer it. John?
But Sarah, the words are literally, you said he did not dictate. The lawyers said he did. What is it?
I'm not going to respond to a letter from the president's outside counsel. We purposely walled off, and I would refer you to them for comment.
So even though she weighed in before and said he didn't dictate it, now she says she can't answer the question when the president's lawyer said he did dictate it. That's our White House today. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin on this drizzly, fog-bound North Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago. I'm here in the Allstate Showcase Studio and historic Tribune Tower as WGN Radio winds down its operations here. We've been informed there's some technical difficulties with our audio stream, so I hope you'll do the old-fashioned way and tune in the radio. Dave?
I was just going to say, you were mentioning about a half hour ago, am I up in the fog? I am. I can't see Tribune Tower. It's definitely foggy.
It's a good thing we have these cameras here, so at least I can see you.
Yes, and that's right. I'm waving.
And you're waving and standing.
Yeah. This console is actually raised up to the point where you can either sit or stand.
Yeah.
But I'm, you know, getting used to the room, which I like very much, by the way. And
it's a gorgeous room. And other than today, it's a beautiful view.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, Thursday morning was just spectacular up here. But the console table itself is up higher than we had on 7. So you can take your choice with either sit or stand. And I'm standing here getting used to everything. Well, getting used to that operation.
You prefer to stand?
I'm making up my mind here. I'm trying it this way.
I can see the chair behind you is there just in case, you know, you need a support.
In case I fall back. But it's got wheels on it, so if I fall back, it will go back.
Yeah, it's not going to help much.
And then I'll go right into the Chicago River.
I would not advise that.
No.
Okay?
Nope.
Especially from the height you're at right now.
Either that or land on the Columbus Bridge, which is under construction right now.
Just create another pothole on the bridge.
More work for the crew to do.
Oh, well, keep us up to date on what's going on with the weather, because it is going to be kind of periodic in and out with rain and potential thunderstorms today.
Yeah, there's two systems right now. The one is that's closer to us is going through the Westmont area and Brookfield, and then there's one south. That is more toward Wilmington and down through the Kankakee area there, and there's one right behind that. So we're going to be seeing some rain off and on, certainly through the morning hours.
It provides more of the cheery atmosphere over here in this Gothic temple known as Tribune Tower. Thanks, Dave.
You bet.
Going back to the national news a bit, there's renewed controversy about immigration policies being enforced under the Trump administration, including forcibly removing children from undocumented parents at the border. Here's Illinois' senior U.S. Senator Dick Durbin.
We are in the process now of facing the worst refugee crisis in the history of the world in so many different places. And the United States, instead of maintaining this image and this model of accepting refugees from other countries under this president, President Donald Trump, has decided to do just the opposite. Not only to cut in half the number of refugees we would clear, review, interrogate, and accept in the United States each year to 50,000 is the official number, but in actuality, only about 18,000 have been accepted so far in the first few months of this year. It's an indication we won't even reach 50,000. But there's something going on as well when it comes to those who seek asylum or refuge in this country that is equally horrifying and objectionable. The Trump administration has decided to discourage those who would come to our borders looking for safety by telling mothers who bring their infants and children that those children will be taken away from them by the government of the United States when they arrive at our border. It's hard to imagine, but that is the stated policy now of the Trump administration. It is a cruel policy. It is not a policy consistent with American values.
So what's going on at the border? Well, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar was asked about this at a recent congressional hearing.
Individual children are separated from their parents only when those parents cross the border illegally and are arrested. We can't have children with parents who are in incarceration, and so then they're given to me. If one presents at an actual border crossing and presents a case to come into this country, one is not arrested and one's children are not separated from them. So the best advice I have is actually present yourself at a legal border crossing and make your case. Cross illegally and get arrested, and your children will be given to us. That's the simple fact, I'm afraid. It's not a desire. Nobody has a desire to separate children from their parents. I certainly don't. We will take as best care of them as humanly possible when entrusted with them.
And that is the Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about Springfield right now, and joining me on the phone is Bill Fleischley. He's Executive Vice President of the Illinois Petroleum Marketers Association and the Illinois Association of Convenience Stores. Bill, thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I hope the weather's a bit better in Springfield than it is here.
It's not much. We're not getting storms. We're getting a little rain. Now, we didn't get the rock and roll storms yet.
Stay tuned. I think they're on their way. I wanted to have Bill on because, and I've known Bill for a long time, but I wanted to have him on because talk about some of the legislation that passed through the recent spring session in Springfield. And one, and this has always been kind of a subject, is involving tobacco and tobacco sales. And for, you know, convenience stores, for gas stations, you know, that is a source of income. And we now have legislation that would raise the age to purchase tobacco products in Illinois. Legislation that's on the governor's desk would raise the age from 18 to 21. And that currently is what the law is in Chicago. But this would expand it statewide. And Bill, your group is opposed to that. Could you give us the reasons for that?
Yeah. Presently, only about 5% of the 18 to 20-year-olds smoke. So the present legislation or law that we have, we think, is working. That means that the training that we gave our sales associates is working. Also, the possession enforcement keeps people from smoking. So we think that we've done a good job with this. The FDA is in charge of it in Washington, D.C. They think 18 is the right age for a person to smoke. If they want to change it, we think it should be changed with a national policy, that every state would have it. All we're doing with this legislation, we're not going to stop these 5% from smoking. We're going to force them, entice them to go over borders and buy cigarettes. And that loses money for not only my members, but it also loses $50 million a year for the state of Illinois.
Well, and that's, I mean, you're actually, you know, we talk about the things going on in the national border, but for the Illinois border, there always seems to be a constant battle between trying to keep business in Illinois for retail, for gas, those kinds of things, compared to the border states.
Absolutely. I mean, we have higher taxes. Let's face it. We have a high sales tax on our gasoline that changes every time the wholesale price goes up. It drives people away. I mean, it drives our gallons should be a lot more. When we did take the sales tax off, gallons went up about 50 or 60% for the 6 months we did it in the year 2000. But we allow these young people to serve in the service. We allow these people to marry. We allow them to make decisions about their health care. We allow them to sit on juries. They certainly have enough knowledge to make a decision, a decision whether they want to smoke or not.
Well, and, you know, obviously, as you say, smoking is down, and there's a general kind of attitude against smoking. And I mean, how do you deal with that as a group and you know, talking about the economic benefit?
Well, smoking is bad. We admit that, but we still think that it ought to be a decision by the person after education and reasoning whether they want to do it or not. You know, there's the same people out there talking about drinking. They talk about fattened foods. They talk about all those things. We think the person who is 18 to 20 years old, if he can vote, if he can join the service, he can make a decision regarding smoking.
I was not familiar with I believe this legislation, it failed initially in the House, I think, and then subsequently was passed. So, I mean, I'm not sure what the roll call was, but it does seem like there is some divide in as far as the members of the General Assembly.
Yes. It was put on postponed consideration. It failed with 54 votes, and it passed the next day with 61 votes. So it's a very divided General Assembly on the matter.
So now it's a matter of trying to work the governor's office.
Yeah, we'd like to see a total veto, but knowing that may be difficult, we think a mandatory veto that brings possession back into the law, possession being illegal. So right now, it is illegal. You have a minor offense if you are caught with cigarettes or using cigarettes illegally at underage. With this law, that goes away. So we're not going to punish anybody, and there's going to be no enforcement for the actual smoking. There'll be enforcement of buying, but there's no enforcement of the actual smoking. We think enforcement should be in it. We think it's working. When you have 5% of those adults, young adults, are smoking, we think it's worked. That's on the positive side of that. 95% don't smoke. If everything could be 95% effective, I think we'd have a lot better tax structure and things like that. Everything would be working a lot better if 95% was good.
We're speaking with Bill Fleischley. He's Executive Vice President of the Illinois Petroleum Marketers Association and the Illinois Association of Convenience Stores. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in historic Tribune Tower on historic North Michigan Avenue, a rainy Michigan Avenue this morning. Joining me on the phone is Bill Fleischley. He's Executive Vice President of the Illinois Petroleum Marketers Association and the Illinois Association of Convenience Stores. We're talking about legislation that passed in Springfield. And, Bill, there was another bill, and I think this may have been prompted because of some of the reporting in the Chicago Tribune, over the issue of selling lottery tickets when the big prizes have already been claimed, and the continuation of selling tickets for these games even though those big prizes aren't available. And I know an earlier Tribune story found that under past lottery management that was a frequent practice, and there were questions raised about the honesty of selling tickets knowing that those big prizes no longer exist.
That's true. Senate Bill 212, there was an amendment put on that dealt with that. And any time we've had publicity that's negative publicity about the lottery, it hurts lottery sales in our retail locations. But I'm convinced that after we've talked to the Camelot people, the new people that are doing the lottery, their business plan, they told me, I think, starts July 1 of this year. We are convinced that they're going to handle the situation, and they're going to be positive and let people know what's going on. They're going to be transparent. And we think that this will go away without the needed legislation. But the legislation woke everybody up, I think. And hopefully it will not be negative. And these things will end. And these people, the new lottery people, got this under control. And this will help bring the lottery back where it was several years ago.
Yeah, well, and I mean, there were some real concerns. And again, this was under previous management about, you know, how honest is it to continue selling and even featuring advertising on some of these games that you can't claim the big prize anymore.
Yes, and there was And there was negative publicity in the lottery regarding big payoffs when we didn't have a budget. Those hurt our sales and things like that. But I think this new company is aware of all this. They have met with us, I mean, the industry, not just me, but the industry that sells lottery tickets on several occasions, two or three occasions. They have come forward with things they want to do that we think that are very positive. And also the transparency on these games is going to be resolved.
How is the lottery doing as far as your customers?
It's been doing good. Very good, but in the last summer when we had the little clip when they came out and said they won't be able to pay the big games off, it went down, and it takes time to recover.
Has it recovered since then?
It's about back to where it was last year, yes. It hasn't grown, but it's back to where it was last year, the sales.
Bill, I also want to ask you, too, and we did not get a comprehensive public improvement capital plan as part of this budget. But obviously it continues to be talked about, and it always has to involve new revenue, and typically that has always involved things like gas taxes. I don't think there was really a great appetite to raise gas taxes, this being an election year, but I'm wondering, looking ahead, you know, obviously the needs of the infrastructure of the state they've languished, and there's going to be a renewed push. What do you see on the horizon about that?
I would imagine in the next general assembly session they're going to talk about revenues for roads. Now, there are other. First of all, I think what we got to make sure is the amendment that was passed in the 2016 election dealing with diversions, money that's targeted.
It's the constitutional amendment that was passed by voters.
Yes. Bring all the money that's supposed to go to roads, goes to roads. That's the first thing that ought to be accomplished. The second thing I think we ought to do is look for other revenue sources. Do I have any in mind? Not publicly, I can say yes, I do, but I can't publicly because my board of directors hasn't said anything about it. But gas tax is always talked about. The problem with gas tax, it's not growing like it used to anymore. Because of different cars, electric cars, I think we have to bring them into the picture. The cars that run on propane and those kind of things, they all got to be brought into the picture. They're using the roads; they should be a part of the money or part of the revenues to fix the roads. That's the big thing we got to do. Yes, there needs to be roads repaired. I'm not going to say that they don't, but if you hit the gas tax, historically, after every gas tax increase, volumes go down between 4% and 7%. So you have to remember, they'll recover, but it takes a while for them to recover.
Well, and you make a good point about electric vehicles, which, you know, initially they were incentivized by the state. And now, you know, they're becoming much more commonplace. And what exactly are they, you know, contributing to road improvement? And you know, do you assign them a higher registration fee, for example, to make up for that? I mean, but I do.
It has to become. They have to. You know, they have to pay their fair share. There's no doubt about it. And they're going to be part of the solution to get ourselves off carbon fuels. They're going to work. It's going to work. But they have to. They have to be part of the solution.
Do you see any way? And you kind of touched on this a little bit about, you know, when we briefly lifted the sales tax on gasoline, which doesn't go to roads, it goes to the general fund. But do you see any kind of trade-off room there?
I tried to initiate that last year in 2016 when they passed the big tax bill. They eliminated the sales tax incentive on ethanol, on 10% blend of ethanol. That was a 20% sales tax reduction that was supposed to go off this year, December 18th. They eliminated it early. I made the suggestion, if you're going to eliminate, and that adds about, in today's price, about 4 to 6 cents a gallon. I made the suggestion that they take, for 5 years, for 7 years, for some years, take that money and put it in to the road fund so we could do the roads. It was a suggestion made, but it wasn't a suggestion ever got to the floor of either house.
And so we continue to kind of wonder what's going to happen here. I don't detect a great deal of favoritism for in mileage kind of assessing of vehicles.
No, that we talked about that when I first started as state government. It was a, we called it a weight distance tax. And I think Oregon tried it, maybe even Kentucky, and it just, it, the, of course, the technology is better now. If everybody had a GPS system, you could probably put a, something on a GPS system where you could check mileage and things like that. But everybody doesn't, and it probably will come someday, but I don't think in the next 5 to 10 years it won't be there.
Well, we will stay tuned with all of this. Bill Fleischley, Executive Vice President of the Illinois Petroleum Marketers Association and the Illinois Association of Convenience Stores. Bill, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you. I appreciate being on the show. I'm a little nervous, but I hope I didn't mess up too bad.
Oh, you're just fine. Talk to you later, Bill.
Thank you. Bye.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning and welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase studio on a rainy North Michigan Avenue. And joining me here in studio and historic Tribune Tower is Illinois Democratic Comptroller Susana Mendoza.
Good morning. I don't see any people hanging out by the windows, though. They'd be soaked.
Well, yeah, but still. It's Chicago. It's a Sunday morning.
I'm a little sad, though, Rick. This is like my last interview at this just iconic, majestic location. It's a bummer.
Well, we will have you over to the new digs up on the 18th floor in the Allstate Skyline studio. Yes. See, we got everything covered.
Still not super excited.
It's a great view. As Dave Schwann's over there doing the news now, and he's got his head in the clouds. So
still a little sad.
Things are slowly clearing.
All right, Dave. That's the Skyline weather report there.
Things are slowly clearing.
I just see fog. That's all I see out of there.
As I told Rick earlier, though, I still can't see Tribune Tower. But hopefully that will change. But no, these new facilities are just beautiful, and you'll enjoy coming over here.
It's really like 21st century, I have to say. It's almost like the new bathrooms at the Billy Goat.
Is it true that you
Four Seasons Hotel? Yeah,
exactly.
There.
Yes.
Is it true you have a collection of lanyards?
They may soon be showing up, yes.
Well, I'm going to add one to your collection.
Oh, excellent.
Last interview with you at the Trib Towers.
Oh.
Illinois Office of Controller lanyard.
An official lanyard. Well, thank you so much.
It won't get you into the Thompson Center without an ID.
Well, I will add this to the collection. Thank you so much. And thank you for waiting till I had moved all of my other garbage out of here.
Of course, because I didn't want it to get lost in the mix,
It's going right here into my bag, right there. Well, thank you for coming on. We've been talking the last couple of weeks, obviously, with the passage of a state budget, one somewhat surprising.
We have a state budget. With everything else going on, people aren't even talking about that. That's the biggest piece of news that we've seen in 4 years, okay? We have a budget.
But it says something that it is news, because in the past, it would be part of the ordinary business of government.
I know. Isn't that crazy? So, well, thankfully, we're back on track where we should be, at least in terms of doing the people's work on time.
But now there are concerns still about provisions for paying down the bill backlog, which had escalated over $16 billion during the impasse. Mm-hmm. And still is around $7 billion.
Yeah, it's about $7.5 today. It fluctuates anywhere between, 6.8 or so to $8 billion, depending on what bills came in and whether or not I've released payment for things like education, right, or health care. We usually have to cobble together the amount of money that we need to make a huge payment. So that's why if people on any given day go to our website, they'll see that the bill backlog might be $6 billion, $6.5 billion one day and $7.5 billion the next. It just depends. But we might be holding on to payments once we release them, then that bill backlog goes back to what is now actually amazingly around $6.5 billion to $7.5 billion versus 16.7 billion.
Yes, so I mean everything
we're
is
moving
relative
in the right direction.
In the
yes,
but what provisions are there to further reduce that backlog?
So again, unfortunately, the income tax that everybody talks about, right? They say, well, we're paying higher income taxes. Why can't you use that money to pay down the bill backlog? I still can't use that money to pay down the bill backlog because that money was just It was needed in order to stop the deficit spending that had been happening under this administration when the income tax that was in place under Quinn expired when Governor Rauner took office. And it would have been okay that that happened because it was a $5 billion hole in our budget automatically. And that would have been okay if they had cut $5 billion worth of expenses during the course of his administration on any given one of those last 4 years. But instead of making cuts or perhaps having maybe not a 5% income tax, but something lower, and a combination of cuts to offset the $5 billion, that would have been okay. But they just continued to spend as if that $5 billion income tax was still coming in, and even above and beyond what the Quinn administration spent. So when you're spending at a deficit of $2.5 billion in any given fiscal year, it's going to be very difficult to make up that money. And you know, this is part of why when I took office and I realized the extent of the deficit spending that had been happening, that we were really, really vigilant about talking about a new piece of legislation like the Debt Transparency Act that allows me and the rest of the public, whether it's the legislature or the media, to see how the money is being spent on a monthly basis instead of just finding the bad news a year after it happened.
Well, let's talk about that Debt Transparency Act, which part of the problem is, and it, this administration's done it, previous administrations do it, they hold back bills. And that puts you in the hot seat because you don't know necessarily what's coming in.
Yeah, so two things. It puts me in the hot seat, and that's okay. I mean, I'm prepared and I've always run to be in the hot seat. But worse yet is that it puts taxpayers in debt for future generations to come. I mean, if you don't know how the state of Illinois is spending your money, obviously if I don't know as the state's chief fiscal officer what's been charged to the state's credit card because I can't see it. And I know it's crazy for people who are listening because they're like, what do you mean you can't see it? But when I took office, I actually couldn't see almost half of the bills that had been incurred by the state of Illinois. They stayed at the governor's state agency level, and I had no visibility on them until we changed the law to allow me to have this monthly, at least, visibility of what the state's liabilities are. But, you know, it sounds like such a crazy thing, but most importantly, the taxpayers, the people who are responsible for paying back this debt, don't know that it's even happening until it's already happened and there's nothing that we can do about it. So this is why, yeah, I might be on the hot seat, but at the end of the day, taxpayers are left, you know, having to carry this bag and pay for it.
I know that there's been a number of bills that you were successful in getting through the General Assembly with bipartisan support.
Yes, I'm so proud of that. Yeah.
Which I think is another signal of what's going on at the top here, that the fact, because they're basically transparency bills.
Yes, they were pretty much all transparency bills. One of them, of course, was the Debt Transparency Act, which we passed last session, but this session we moved five transparency bills. Well, four of them were transparency, one of them was about minority contracting, but principally four of these bills dealt specifically with shining greater light, if you want to say sunshine, on what's happening with our state's finances, because as they say, sunshine is the greatest disinfectant, right? We want people to know how their money's being spent, and we want the governor and the legislature to have to be accountable to the taxpayers as to how they plan to pay down the debt that's been incurred by the state.
Well, I want to get to some detail on those, but we need to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined here in studio by Illinois State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. We've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome as always to the Sunday Spin.
Hey, good morning. Hey, Rick, first, before I get to my question, I really, truly have to thank you for allowing me to be a guest in that wonderful, historic studio.
Awesome.
Well, you absolutely earned that role, that's for sure. Thanks so much for listening, Ron.
Yeah, thank you, Rick. Ms. Mendoza, question. Yeah. Last week, Standard & Poor's came out with some kind of analysis of the budget. And one thing they did question some of the projected revenue. They mentioned, for example, it's based on the Thompson Center. So just maybe can you talk about the projected revenues and just how confident that you are of the state bringing those revenues in? Okay. Thanks. And again, Rick, have a wonderful day. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Ron.
Thanks for your question, Ron. So I'm confident in some areas and not confident in other areas. So the sale of the Thompson Center is something that pretty much seems like it's just become a staple that they put in the budget every year.
It fills the $270 million
hole. I don't believe
hole.
It's legit is my take on that. So I'll believe it when I see it. I also think, like, if you've ever even tried to sell your home, you know, it's not a super quick process. And selling the Thompson Center is not going to be the easiest thing to potentially sell, you know, within a fiscal fiscal year. Yeah. So I think that they need to be more realistic and honest with the public as to if they really do believe that they can sell, we'd like to see some movement on that before I actually believe that that's going to happen. So
and we've seen the hurdles too with the, you know, questions involving Emanuel's administration, issues about the CTA stop, and how does that, who's going to cover those kinds of costs.
But you saw what happened last year. I mean, they had a deal. The mayor had gotten somebody to actually give more than what the governor said he needed in his budget to sell that, and then the governor actually said, nah, you know what, that's not a good enough deal. Now I want a building that's even taller than the Willis Tower, right? So it's so crazy to me. Like, you're there, you have the victory, it's on a silver platter, and it's just never good enough, right? So how can you say that you want to sell the building for, let's say, $250, they offer you $3, and then you're like, you're going to change the parameters again? So these deals fall through all the time, and I don't think that they've been taken seriously. So you should not be including that in the budget if you don't really believe that it's going to happen. They keep saying it's going to happen. Like I said, I'll see it when I believe it.
I wanted to talk about some of these bills that we were talking about before the break. And one is the Truth in Hiring Act, which this has been a longtime practice of administrations, both Republican and Democrat, of parking people that work for the governor and attaching their salaries to various state agencies so it doesn't look like it comes from the governor's office, in a way to look like, oh, I cut spending in the governor's office. Well, yeah, because you parked five people over here at the administration, some different administrative place. And, you know, we've seen it with Rauner. I mean, I go back to Dan Walker, and he... there was a guy named Pat Quinn that he parked at the Illinois Industrial Commission.
Who later became a chronic offender of this deceptive practice.
Right? As governor.
For sure, yeah.
So this, I mean, in essence, this finally assigns people to, or requires the administration to say where these people are parked?
Yeah, so it wouldn't be legal for them to do that anymore, right? So, and there's two things here at play with offshoring. And offshoring, for people who don't know, that's, you know, I think you explained it pretty well, is that the governor, for example, and again, this is Democratic and Republican governors, as far back as we can tell. This year, Governor Rauner said that he had 44 employees on his payroll. And that cost taxpayers $4.9 million for that payroll. When in essence, he doesn't have 44 employees. The reality of it is that he has 102 employees. 58 employees are actually hidden in other state agencies. They're paid for, even though they work directly for Governor Rauner, they're paid for out of budgets that pertain to other state agencies. And why is this important? Number one, because it's taking necessary dollars that those state agencies need for the operations of their own agencies away from them and into the governor's payroll in a way that the people don't even know that. It's not transparent at all. And the other reason why this is really important is because it's an issue of separation of powers, that per the Constitution, the governor has certain duties. I have certain duties. And the legislative branch, which is an equal but separate branch, has the duty and the constitutional obligation of appropriating funds. That means determining what the budget levels are for all of the state agencies and all the constitutional officers. That is not the governor's job. So, in essence, if the Department of Human Services comes to the General Assembly, to the legislature, and they say, we need $1 million, and we need it for autism programs and all these other kind of issues like that that the Department of Human Services would deal with. And then, after the budget is approved by the legislature in that respect, they say you get $1 million. Then the governor, after the budget's been signed, when there's no more eyes on it, goes in and takes, let's say, $200,000 out of that department to use to hire, you know, a new person that he wants working for him. It's so disingenuous. It's deceptive. It takes needed dollars from public safety, from human services, and that should not happen anymore. He campaigned against it, yet he actually doubled down on what Pat Quinn was doing, a Democratic governor, and, like, perfected it even more. And so, you know, I'm putting a stop to it. The legislature voted with me, I believe, unanimously on that bill in the House. Maybe a few people voted, like seven, I think, in the Senate might have voted against it. I might be confusing myself because my bills just passed pretty overwhelmingly this session. I'm very happy about that. But long story short, we need to put a stop to this practice. And people just need to know that when their governor, whoever that governor may be, Democratic or Republican, presents the budget to the people, that that number is properly reflected and it's an honest figure. We deserve honest budgets.
I want to switch gears here in the closing seconds that we have with you. The Me Too movement, obviously, and we saw issues renewed involving Speaker Madigan and his decision to rid himself of his longtime chief of staff, Tim Mapes. You were named to head a three-person panel to examine these issues as far as the Democratic Party is concerned. Can you give us an update on where that panel is?
Sure. So we are, myself, Representative Carol Ammons, and Senator Melinda Bush are part of the Anti-Harassment, Equality, and Access Panel. And we are not an investigative panel, but what we are charged with doing is coming up with a set of recommendations that any party, not just the Democratic Party, but any party or anyone who wants to actually read these and say that we can do better, we'll be able to utilize to make it a better workplace environment, right, where people don't feel unsafe going to their work, both from a sexual harassment perspective, but also from a safety at the workplace, right? It could be bullying. People don't feel safe at their work because of those situations. Harassment is not just sexual in nature. There's other ways, but we want to tackle the issue of sexual harassment. What processes could be put in place that would prevent these cases from actually happening, that women could feel comfortable going to a certain avenue to address their issue? You know, the woman who accused Tim Mapes said there was nowhere she could go. I mean, he is really the person that should have been handling those things in the absence of a human resources department. And so we need to really, like, come up with this standard of best practices that our party or even the Republican Party or any other party can look at. Beyond the issue of sexual harassment and workplace safety is the issue of accessibility for women into, for example, whether it's the Democratic Party or, again, the Republican Party. We can do better. And we have to figure out what are those barriers and obstacles to entry that prohibit women from rising within the staffing ranks as well as rising within the party itself. Women who want to run for public office. You know, there are so many obstacles for us. It's tough even for a guy to do it, but if it's tough for a guy, you can imagine how many more obstacles are in place for women. So whether it's investing more in female candidates or giving greater amount of resources, recruitment tools for female candidates, there's a lot of things that our panel is going to try to address that will make it a better work environment, both for people wanting to get involved on the political side, but also on the government side.
That's Illinois Democratic Comptroller Susana Mendoza. Comptroller, thank you so much for joining me this
morning. Thanks for having me, and good luck. I'll see you at the next place.
We'll see you at the next place. Right, there's always a next place.
Thanks, Rick.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We know last week the president canceled a scheduled visit by the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles to the White House. Many Eagle players and officials didn't want to go because of the dust-up over the national anthem protests. But Sarah Huckabee Sanders went further and said that the Eagles arranged this all as a political stunt that forced the president to cancel their appearance.
Look, if this wasn't a political stunt by the Eagles franchise, then they wouldn't have planned to attend the event and then backed out at the last minute. And if it wasn't a political stunt, then they wouldn't have attempted to reschedule the visit when they knew that the president was going to be overseas. And if this wasn't a political stunt, they wouldn't have waited until Monday, well after 1,000 of their fans had traveled and taken time out of their schedule, to offer only a tiny handful of representatives to attend the event. Pamela?
To be clear on that point, this isn't about the national anthem. It's about so few players coming in the end, correct?
Certainly the president has been very clear what his position is in regards to the national anthem. We've never wavered on that. The president thinks that people should stand for the national anthem, particularly when it comes to the NFL. It's not about a particular team. It's about having pride in our country.
And, of course, the fact is that nobody from the Philadelphia Eagles took a knee during a national anthem during last season, despite the president's outburst that this indeed was about the national anthem. But it's a political stunt by the football team. That's the spin from the White House. We're going to switch gears and talk about Springfield and talk about the state of Illinois and some good things for a change about the state of Illinois with State Representative Tim Butler, Republican from Springfield, known Tim for many years, been, I would say, a governmental operative.
Not a political operative, but a governmental operative.
With his work with
20 plus years, yeah.
Yes, and he's also a member of the Illinois Bicentennial Commission.
Yep.
And it's your first time here in the Showcase studio. Unfortunately, one of the last people to be here.
I've been in here before with Ray LaHood when he was on here, but that's not certainly as a guest. So it's a big honor for me to be in here, and certainly a bittersweet time to be in the Tribune building, that's for sure.
Well, glad to have you here. And as I said, you know, lost in all of the political battles and everything is the fact this is the 200th anniversary of the state of Illinois. And there's all kinds of celebrations being planned, but I don't think it's getting as much attention as it should.
Yeah, unfortunately, especially given the last couple of years, what we've had in state government with the budget impasse and some of the problems that we have, I think we've kind of lost the idea that we are celebrating our 200th anniversary in December of this year. And so the governor, about a year and a half ago, constituted a bicentennial commission to help plan statewide for things to help us celebrate the 200th birthday. I was honored to be appointed the Leader Durkin's appointee to the Bicentennial Commission. So we get together, the commission gets together on a quarterly basis. We just got together on Thursday here in Chicago and to help plan the activities. There's some staff, there's a governor's office of the Bicentennial that have helped plan it. So really there are a lot of items happening around the state, have been happening throughout the year, and will be culminating on December 3rd, which is Statehood Day, with a gala celebration at the United Center, which should be a pretty cool event.
But a lot of stuff going on around Springfield.
Absolutely. There's in Springfield, we've got a lot of activities taking place. The governor's mansion has been rehabbed, a $15 million renovation of the governor's mansion that's been led by Governor Rauner that will be officially open to the public again in July. We've got the Bicentennial Plaza under construction, which is right by the governor's mansion across the street. The Illinois Realtors have put in money to reconstruct the street into a pedestrian plaza. It'll be a great gathering spot in Springfield. All sorts of activities. The Presidential Museum has a great exhibit of the four presidents from Illinois, Lincoln, Grant, Reagan, and Obama, that's in celebration of our bicentennial year, and all sorts of good activities that are happening, that's for sure.
Well, and as I said, when we talk about the politics and kind of the divisiveness, there's also the kind of a regional divisiveness that exists too, and it's hard to remember that that's part of our diversity, is part of the strength of the state.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a very diverse state. From Wisconsin to Kentucky, basically, you see a wide variety of people and backgrounds, accents, everything across the state. My family's history, as with so many people, started with coming up through southern Illinois as Illinois was settled, going north, actually. A lot of people forget Chicago always wasn't the largest city in the state of Illinois. We were settled from the south up. And so that's one of the things that we're celebrating during the bicentennial is the differences in the state of Illinois and the heritage that we have as kind of a melting pot of the country and the way that we've come together. And I think it's an exciting time for the state. We have come through some tough times, and I think it's good for us to reflect back on our 200 years on who we are and then look forward to the future. I do think even though we struggle as a state right now, we do have a bright future. We're smack dab in the middle of the country. We're a leader in so many things across the country. We're a transportation hub. We're a leader in business, things like agriculture. We're a leader in the arts. And I think we have a lot of good things to celebrate and certainly a lot of good things that will carry us forward.
Well, and you with your familiarity with Central Illinois, I mean, one of the things, this, I think it'd be a great time to use this bicentennial and do a Route 66 tour.
Well, you know me well. I'm a Route 66 fan. I live on Route 66, an original lineman of 66 in Springfield. A lot of people don't realize that Route 66 just begins right down the street here, right by the Art Institute. And actually, the governor's going to lead a motorcycle ride down Route 66 on August 26th to make some stops along the way, which should be a great thing. 66 is really, I think, an untapped thing for our state when it comes to tourism.
I mean, I know there's people like you and there's a number of great devotees, but there's so much more, I think, that could be done.
I see it so much in Springfield. The international visitors that we get on Route 66 is amazing. I was out doing a TV interview for a local TV station in Springfield the other day outside of a North End a restaurant in Springfield that's kind of a 66 icon. And a gentleman walked up from Bremen, Germany, who was traveling across 66 and just stopped to take some photos of that location. And that, I think that really underscores the fact that there's so many international visitors, so many European visitors, so many Chinese visitors as well, that they have a bucket list item to fly into Chicago, rent a car, rent a motorcycle, and drive across 66. And it's really amazing to see. It's actually, you know, there's as many people that come into Springfield for 66 as there are for Lincoln. It's pretty,
is it really?
It's amazing thing. I mean, it's, and many more international visitors, honestly. And in a place like Springfield where you can bring Lincoln and 66 together, it certainly has a lot to offer for people who want to come check out the capital city.
They're all there for the cozy dog.
Cozy dog. Don't eat too many of those, but they're very good. They're very good.
We're speaking to Republican State Representative Tim Butler from Springfield. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue, where conditions seem to be clearing up just a bit. And joining me here in studio is Republican State Representative Tim Butler from Springfield. We were talking about the Illinois Bicentennial coming up. The Statehood Day is in December.
December 3rd. December 3rd is when President Monroe signed the congressional authorization, and we became the 21st state.
I feel so old because I remember the sesquicentennial. Okay.
You know, so even though we're both Cubs fans here, but since we're in the Sox studio, the Sox did a really neat thing this summer. It's also the 50th anniversary of the A's moving to Oakland.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, a month or so ago, it was throwback night for the A's when they were playing in Oakland. And the Sox wore 1968 uniforms with the sesquicentennial patch
on it.
The patch,
really?
from the sesquicentennial year. So it was a pretty cool thing.
Wow.
For the Sox. Yeah.
The Sox do a lot of cool things.
Yeah.
They really do. We talked about the bicentennial. We talked about state diversity. I want to ask you, coming out of this past spring session, I detected an unusual tone of optimism. And I hate to say that it was an unusual tone, but I not like it's kumbaya times, but just kind of a realization factor that, you know, we can do better than what we've done before.
This is my, I was sworn in 2015, so this is actually my fourth spring session that I've been there at the state capitol. And everyone's been different. The attitude and the atmosphere in each one has been different every year that I've been there. Obviously, the two that we had the budget impasse were really three that we had a budget impasse the first 3 years,
right,
were very difficult. And I think this spring there was a realization that we didn't want to go down that path again. Very honestly, it was a little easier to craft a budget this year, given the fact that the tax increase was implemented over the governor's veto and the objection of some of us last year. But that certainly lays the groundwork from a revenue side of things. But at the end of the day, I think the governor and the four leaders allowed some rank and file members to come together and craft a bipartisan budget that's at least we believe is balanced. So we'll see with things like the Thompson Sales Center you were talking about earlier. And I think that really kind of pervaded kind of the atmosphere and the attitude for the entire General Assembly this spring. We didn't see as much acrimony as we've seen over the last few years. I think people kind of kept everything in check. And hopefully moving forward, we're past what we've seen over the last few years, and we can move forward. We've got a lot of big challenges in this state. We all know property taxes are a burden in this state. The overall tax burden is bad in this state. We're seeing people leave the state. We need to address those situations. But I think this was a step in the right direction with a bipartisan budget and hopefully a different attitude for state government.
Well, I think my story last Sunday, I said only in Illinois couldn't an election year bring a sense of normalcy to things.
That's true. But it's only June, so I'm sure things will get crazy between now and November.
Sure. But the fact that this seemed to be driven, I think, as you alluded to, that this was driven more bottom up.
It really was. And I think, you know, we had some good people from the House Republican Caucus, people like Tom Demmer and Patty Bellick that kind of led the charge. The Democrats did as well. I know, you know, Greg Harris on the House Dem side kind of led the charge. So, you know, it really was an effort to, like you said, get back to normalcy. But there was a lot of input from regular members. I had a lot of discussions with our folks who were at the table about items that were or were not in the budget, which I think was good. And that is something that's different than we've seen over the past few years. I wish we would get back to a more normal process where the appropriations committees are actually having some oversight of revenue and spending. I think that would be a good thing. But maybe, you know, in the next session, that's something we can get back to and have even more normalcy with it.
Well, and I was nothing against the leadership, but it just seemed that, you know, we've seen that game played out before. And then it's become a game of one-upsmanship where the members just have to, you know, kind of take it.
Well, I think,
hands.
You know, it became obvious over the last few years that it was very difficult for the governor and the speaker to sit in the room together and have a discussion for whatever reason. And I think that really made it difficult to move forward. So to have some of the more, you know, non-leadership members get in the room together and just basically tell everybody this is the way we're going to go, I think it's been a good thing. But we'll see if it lasts. I won't discount as well things that have happened from coming out of the Me Too movement and how that's kind of overshadowed things at the state capitol. Obviously, we've seen some things in the last couple weeks that have broke that are big issues. But I think that helped, in a way, focus on some big issues like that we need to focus on. I'm on the House Sexual Discrimination and Harassment Task Force and talking about some of those issues, you know, at the same time while we're trying to craft a budget, hopefully has led to the rhetoric being toned down a little bit while we're trying to tackle some of these big issues.
And, I mean, and that's an issue that isn't really a partisan issue.
It's not. Not at all. Not at all. It's something that we need to address and we need to take care of, and we need to make sure people are educated. You saw with the woman that came forward the other day when she says that she didn't know where to turn to address the concerns that she's having, the problems that she's faced. I think that's a real issue for those of us in our positions. We need to make sure that staff know exactly where to turn. And that's we need to have a system in place that ensures that staff are taken care of when they have these concerns. And we need to make sure that they're educated and give them the resources that they need.
Yeah, it's not like there's an HR office.
No, and that's one of the big things, you know, from me being on the congressional level, being a staff person on the congressional level for so long, we would have, you know, the U.S. House has a very professional, well-run kind of HR human resources organization that you know where to turn. We really don't have that per se in the state house, not certainly on that kind of level. And I think that is something we probably need to take a look at. You don't need a partisan HR department. It can be one that helps, you know, both caucuses,
almost like a CMS,
right?
CMS,
yeah, exactly, kind of, exactly. And that's, you know, that's what they do on the federal level in Congress. And I think that would be a good example to use as we move forward to try to address some of these issues.
That's Tim Butler, Republican State Representative from Springfield and a member of the Illinois Bicentennial Commission. Tim, great to have you here in studio.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.